Hey, hey, Walking the Floor is made possible with support from Fender Play. Have you or someone you know been looking to learn how to play the guitar? Well, my friends over at Fender recently introduced Fender Play, the complete learning platform from the most trusted name in guitar. And it really is the quickest and easiest way to learn how to play. With on-demand guitar lessons through a video-based platform designed to help you play your favorite songs and learn key skills in minutes. For your free trial of Fender Play, please visit Fender.com/walkingthefloor.
Walking the Floor?
Yeah, that's the name of the podcast.
Okay. Hi, this is Ace Frehley, and you're listening to Walking the Floor. We'll be right back.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to Walking the Floor. You know, my wife the other day told me that that I talk in a cowboy accent on my podcast, in my little preamble ramble. So I'm going to do everything in my power today to speak in the most plain, boring, non-cowboy accent I can possibly muster. Anyway, this is a really, really special episode because today's guest is Ace frickin' Frehley. Ace Frehley from Kiss. The whole reason I play guitar, that's today's episode. So I'll get to that in a minute. First, I just wanted to talk a little bit about being home, man. It's kind of hard being home sometimes when you've been out on the road for a nice long stretch. You know, you've been out on the road for a couple of years and you're putting things off and you come home for a couple of days and you're like letting things stack up and you're just not getting to stuff. So now I've been home for a few weeks. I got to like deal with life. Got a lot of life. I got a lot of things I'm trying to slog through every day. I'm like making lists and calling people and checking stuff off. And I'm getting ready to do all that touring next year. Opening for Blackberry Smoke and opening for Elizabeth Cook and playing with Kendall Marvel. All that stuff in January, February, and March. So there's a lot of stuff that I got to do to get ready for that. Like designing new t-shirts and getting an album cover together and buying a van and, you know, scheduling rehearsals and getting the boys back together and learning the new songs. And I think we're going to be ready come into January. And if you're not ready, if you haven't bought your tickets yet, make sure you get on over to chrisshiflettmusic.com. All the links for all the tickets, all the shows with Blackberry Smoke, all the shows with Elizabeth Cook and Kendall Marvel, it's all there. And there's still tickets left, so get on it before they're gone. Okay. Again, a big thanks to my good friends at Fender Play for making this episode of Walking the Floor free. Fender Play is, of course, the complete learning platform from the most trusted name in guitar, available on desktop and mobile, so you can learn anytime, anywhere. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go over to my Fender Play app, and I'm going to watch the Learn to Fly tutorial. And I'm just going to double check it. I'm going to make sure they got all the chords right and the different voicings and whatnot. And I'm just going to do a little homework on it. Maybe I'm playing it wrong. Maybe I've been playing it wrong all these years. And I'm going to go learn how to play it right on Fender Play. So why don't you get your free trial of Fender Play at Fender.com/walkingthefloor. And let's not forget that support for Walking the Floor also comes from D'Addario. D'Addario, a fine maker of USA-made instrument strings and musical accessories, is committed to sustainability through the Playback Program, recycling over 1 million used instrument strings. For more information on the Playback Program and how to help in its mission of reaching 2.5 million strings in 2018, visit playback.daddario.com. And last but not least, our good pals at Zounds.com. Did you know every order of $599 and above is eligible for their exclusive 12-part payment plan over there at Zounds.com? There's no interest charged ever. There's free shipping on every single order, and most of those orders arrive within 2 days. So get on over to Zounds.com and buy your Fender and D'Addario products. Check it out. Just wrapped it all up. Tied it all up with a bow right there in the end. Boom! All right, let's get to today's interview. I must have been about 5 years old. It was like 1976, I think. We were living in Maryland. We were little kids. And my brother Scott went out and traded one of our neighbors a couple of records for the first three Kiss records, packaged together as the originals. And he brought that home, and my life was changed forever. Now, today's interview is with Ace Frehley from Kiss, the original guitar player in Kiss through all the glory years. And Ace Frehley is, without question, the single most important reason why I play guitar. It's just to say I idolized him as a little boy is a massive understatement. I loved Ace Frehley so much. I had his pictures all over my walls. I was obsessed with him. I stuck with Kiss through the lean years of Unmasked and The Elder, back to the glory days of the reunion tours in the 90s, and I've just been a massive fan of this guy the whole time. So I was so nervous going into this interview because there was so much I wanted to ask him about, and I'd never really met him before. I mean, I kind of met him briefly a couple times, but I never really met him. I even went to the listening party for his latest record, Spaceman, the night before, and I went up and I took a picture with him. I said, "Hey, man, I'm going to interview you tomorrow." He said, "You better have some good questions." I was like, "Oh, God." Just made me more nervous going into it, but he turned out to be fantastic. We had a great talk that I'm going to play for you right now. We cover everything. This is Ace Frehley on Walking the Floor. Do you remember Gene Simmons' birthday party in 1977 at Neil Bogart's house? Do you have any memory of that night?
Not very well. I thought you were going to say the bowling alley party.
No. It was Neil Bogart. Okay, I was there.
Okay.
I was at his with my brothers at his birthday party at Neil Bogart's house because my aunts worked at Casablanca. And one of my aunts married.
How old were you?
I was six. And so they tried to not let me go. So it was my aunts worked at Casablanca. One of my aunts, my Aunt Candy, married Larry Harris, who was Neil Bogart's.
Larry just passed away.
Yes, exactly. So you remember
called
Larry.
He called me like a year or two ago when he was promoting his book and asked me if I would make an appearance with him and do some talking on the stage. Because I guess he was doing a book tour.
Yeah.
It never materialized.
Oh, yeah. The book was great. It was. I don't know if you ever read the book, but it was great. Yeah, it was really good.
The book was good?
It was fantastic.
I got to pick it up.
So we had just moved out here from Maryland, right? And we'd just gotten into Kiss.
Why did you move out from Maryland?
Well, because my parents got divorced and, you know, my dad was out there and my mom was out here. So we moved out here. It was my mom's sisters and then, you know, one of them married Larry.
Gotcha.
And so they were going to take, they found out that me and my brothers were Kiss fans. So they were going to take just my brothers. And I pitched such a shit fit that I forced my way. And I barely remember it. I have I think my memories are sort of like almost like made up from my brother's telling of it. But
well, stranger things have happened.
Have you been out here promoing your new record all week?
That's why I'm here. This is the last day. I got here Sunday night. Monday noon, I was at Jimmy Kimmel doing a sound check with the band. Because I sat in with the Jimmy Kimmel band and then I had the listening party last night. Tuesday I did a ton of press. And today's the last day. I'm driving back tonight.
How sick of doing promo are you after all these years?
I'm not sick of it. It's been interesting, and most of the interviewers ask good questions. You know, when I do phoners, it gets really crazy. I'm sure you've done it. You know, the phoner, you know, when you're doing phoners, people ask the same questions over and over again. Right. And then you forget who you're talking to.
When you're doing interviews, it's like the same 5 or 10 questions pretty much every time.
It's a lot easier doing an interview one-on-one and, you know, people get a better sense of who they're talking to and maybe come up with more original questions.
We got to talk about your new record. And I know this is not an original question, but tell me about Spaceman.
What's there to tell? So we released Bronx Boy, which is kind of me and my friend Ronnie Mancuso from Vegas wrote that song. He pretty much came over to my home studio with this song, and the lyrics weren't very good. They didn't go with anything that but the music was pretty good. So I ended up rewriting all the lyrics and talking about my days in the Bronx. So it was a little autobiographical.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the first single released. And then Rockin' with the Boys was the second single released.
And that's a song from that you wrote back in the 70s, right?
The chorus I wrote in the 70s, and I've done a couple of versions of it over the years, but I never was happy with the verses and the bridge. And, you know, when I was recording this record, I took another stab at it.
Hmm.
And the verses and the choruses came together.
Is there a version of that from the 70s that you worked up with Kiss back then?
I never presented that song to Kiss. It was just something I had written, and, you know, I never presented anything that I didn't think was finished and was good.
Right, right, right.
And since that song never really got finished to my satisfaction, it was never presented to a Kiss cut.
I mean, what was that like in a band that had two sort of established songwriters? And I know you were writing the whole time.
Well, not really. I really wasn't a songwriter. I learned a lot from Paul and Gene. You know, Shock Me was one of the first songs I've written. Love Theme was pretty much my idea. Yeah,
but Cold Gin, didn't you write Cold Gin?
Oh, yeah, I wrote Cold Gin. I wrote that on the subway going down to rehearsal. I came up with that riff in my head, and then I put it together. And actually, Gene wrote the breakdown section.
Mm.
But he never took credit for it. He just said, Ace, it's your song. You know, because I wasn't like writing a lot of songs at the time. So he was nice enough to say, I'm not going to take any credit. You know, it's your song, Cold Gin.
Was that hard to like present your songs at that time in the early days when you had these two guys,
you know,
that were writing songs?
I was more insecure back then. I had never done a lead vocal. You know, I had written like songs like Getaway and Cold Gin, but wouldn't sing them.
Right.
And, you know, now obviously I'm singing them live. And,
sure.
You know, my voice is a lot stronger than it used to be, and I sing with a lot more authority. And I do it out of necessity, not so much because I want to be a lead singer. But, you know, I've always had two guitars, bass, and drums. I've never had a band with a front man. So I pretty much sing out of necessity.
I feel like that's how a lot of rock and roll singers start.
Yeah.
You know? Just because there's nobody else band that's willing to
Steven
do it.
Steven Tyler, you know? Used to be a drummer.
Right, sure.
And, you know, I met Steven before Aerosmith broke, you know, because I used to hang out up in Westchester County. I actually dated his old girlfriend, Debbie Benson.
Really?
A little tidbit there of trivia. She took me to a concert of theirs. They were playing some college auditorium. You know, it was before their album broke. I think their first album came out, and I think Kiss's first album came out like 3 or 6 months later. Mm. It was like real close.
Can you talk about those early days that you're referencing in Kiss? Like, there's a mythology that has developed over the years.
The only thing I can tell you about, you know, when I auditioned for Kiss, you know, there was no makeup yet.
Sure.
Didn't have a name. And once they hired me, because they had hired Peter for a while, and it was a trio, then I was the last one to join. But the one thing that we all agreed upon was that we wanted to be famous and we wanted to have a theatrical rock group. Those were the two things that we were all agreed upon.
Right.
And play hard rock and roll. And, you know, everything just developed over time, you know. Designing the makeup, you know, there were different incarnations of Paul's makeup. You know, I pretty much did my alter ego because I'm a big sci-fi fan.
Mm.
And when it came time for me to design a costume and be this guy in makeup on stage, I went for a sci-fi look. You know, Gene's a monster. Movie monster fan, and, you know, so his alter ego was, you know, a monster. You know, Peter loved cats. He's got a cat fetish. It just goes on and on. It's so weird.
But there's like, you know, the sort of mythology surrounding Kiss is that you have Gene and Paul are like the businessmen guys, and then Peter and Ace were the party guys. You know what I mean? But was there a time?
That's pretty much true. Paul and Gene. Okay,
I was going to say, was there a time though early on when everybody was just kind of working on towards the same goal, on the same page?
Me and
you know,
Peter
before that
in the beginning weren't as loaded as we were once we became famous. like after Alive broke and we all ended up having our own bodyguards, our own limos, our own suites. You know, prior to that, me and Gene were rooming together in Holiday Inns.
Right.
So I couldn't get as crazy as I could if I was alone, because Gene would see it
and keep you in check
a little
bit.
And then he'd say, "What the fuck are you doing?"
Right,
you
know? Right, right.
So, you know, once we Alive took off and we started playing stadiums and arenas, you know, we had enough money to afford our own private suites. We hired 4 bodyguards. You know, a lot of times we had our own limo, or 2 of us would share a limo. And at that point, you know, the money started rolling in. You know, the women started rolling in, and the drugs started rolling in. And, you know, it was too much too soon. And, of course, I went overboard with it eventually, did Peter.
But those mythologies, like, it seems like when you sort of dive a little deeper in them, they're never quite so black and white. You know what I mean? Was there a little more overlap than is sort of talked about between the sort of 2 camps, the business side and the party side?
Well, I mean, I wasn't always loaded, you know. I mean, I was very cognizant at a lot of business meetings and gave my 2 cents. A lot of times I saved Paul and Gene from making blunders, you know. They'd come up with ideas that really weren't good, and I'd shoot it down, and thank God they'd listen to me.
What would be an example of that be?
Well, somehow, some way, some lighting director talked Paul and Gene into using the system where above us would be this big mirror, and the spots would be in the pit, and we bounced the spots off the mirror. And I said, "What? Are you kidding? you want to pay for this? You want to have spotlight guys in the pit, you know, I want to be able to see the fans. I don't want a spotlight going in my eyes or bouncing off a mirror. And not only that, the mirror is going to block the view from the people sitting behind us in a circular arena. So, you know,
how to lose money and have technical
problems
every night.
But they were going to go with it. And I talked to Peter. I said, "Look, we got to talk these guys out of doing this. This is a bad idea." And they listened to me. When it came to The Elder, they didn't listen to me. And of course, the album bombed. What are you going to do?
I got to tell you, when that album came out, I went and bought that record. And, you know, that was, and I'm going to get to this in the series, because it's actually kind of a fascinating period of rock music to me. But I remember putting that album on, and the first song was The Oath on the original track listing of it. I think it's different now on Spotify. Mm-hmm. And that came on, it's just, took it on. I was like, "Fuck, yeah." Until Darklight. It was bleak thought, until yeah. Darklight.
Darklight was fun.
The guitar solo in Darklight in particular.
Yeah, that's not bad. You know what my favorite solo on that record is?
Which one?
That one with the slow delay, long delay. And I honestly don't
remember that one. It's been a long time since I listened to that one.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. You know, people listening are gonna know which song I'm talking about. That are fans.
Well, let's back up a little bit. Like, what drew you to music, and in particular playing guitar in the first place? Like when you were a kid.
Well, when I was a teenager, I got involved in music. I grew up in a musical family. I was the youngest of 3 kids. Everybody in my family played piano. My brother and sister picked up a folk guitar. They were, you know, they were folkies. They were doing Peter, Paul, and Mary.
This is like, what, mid-60s?
Let's see. When I was 13, I was born in 51, 61. 64, I picked up my guitar. My brother taught me a few, like, ED&A, and I would, you know, work out some stuff on his acoustic guitar. And then I said, "I like this." And then that Christmas, I asked my dad for an electric guitar and a little amp, and, you know, it was love. Love for, you know.
Like, who are you guys? What were you listening to? Who were your guitar influences?
Oh, I mean, obviously the Beatles and the Stones, but, you know, the whole English invasion, you know, the Who, the Cream. I mean, I saw Cream's first New York appearance.
Really?
I saw the Who's first New York appearance. I saw Led Zeppelin's first New York appearance.
Really?
Opening up for Iron Butterfly at the Fillmore East.
No shit.
And then after they got off, half the audience walked out on the headliner.
So growing up in New York, you must have had access to everything.
I did.
I mean, so you were going into the city and seeing shows all the time.
Yeah, I cut school, and Murray the K used to put on rock shows, and the headliner was Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels.
Right.
And opening up for them with a Who and the Cream.
And that would have been only a few years before Kiss first got together, right?
No, I was in a lot of bands, and then, you know, prior to Kiss, I was in a group called Malema, who actually recorded at RCA Studios.
Oh, wow.
And then Kiss happened in 72, 73, something like that.
So what was your first guitar rig? Like in the early days of Kiss?
I used to use an Epiphone.
Well, because, yeah, I've seen that. I've seen pictures of, or like an Ovation or something. What was the weird shaped guitar?
Well, really, I had an Ovation for a very short time.
Okay.
But I put humbuckers in it. Actually, I still have the pickups, and they were hand wound by DiMarzio.
What, you go back that far with DiMarzio?
In his bedroom.
Really?
Larry DiMarzio used to hand wind pickups in his bedroom with this spooling device. And I used to meet him at Staten Island Ferry and get the pickup.
No
shit.
Put
it inside my guitar. So I used to hot rod.
So that was like a local company?
It was way before Larry went, got big, yeah. He was hand winding. He was making pickups in his bedroom at home with his mom and dad.
So you've held on to some of that gear from those guys?
I have two or three of the original pickups that he personally hand wound.
What about those guitars?
The guitars are pretty much all gone. I upgraded. You know, as soon as we got money, I bought a Les Paul Standard, Tobacco Sunburst, and a Marshall, you know. And then from then on, it was Les Pauls pretty much. You know, in the recording studio, I like to use Fenders and other guitars to thicken up the sound. You know, there's nothing like recording a track with Les Paul and then doubling it with a Strat or a Tele. Because, you know, you get a completely different harmonic range from a Fender.
Right.
You do from a Les Paul, but when you blend them together correctly, you get a thick sound.
Were you playing Fenders in the early days?
Actually, I did have a Tele that I actually sawed off the horn and the part. I made it into a teardrop.
Back in those days, did you just have like 59s and shit like that sitting around? Like, 'cause that shit wasn't expensive yet at that point, right?
I bought my first 59 Les Paul Sunburst, which is... This is an exact copy of it. They got the original guitar that I used to own.
Yeah.
Which is now worth about $350,000.
Do you know where that guitar is? Is that like in some
I know the guy
hands?
Who owns it. He's a friend of mine. But, you know, a lot of people say to me, why a Les Paul? You know, why not a Strat or, you know. I said, well, take a Strat and lay it on a table on a lace flat. Try to do that with a Les Paul. There's an arch.
Hmm.
You know, the neck on a Les Paul is at a 6-degree angle.
Right.
And what happens is when you tighten the strings, it creates tension, and that's what gives you the sustain on the Les Paul that a Strat doesn't have.
I have to warn you that Fender is the main sponsor of my podcast, and they're going to be very upset when they hear this interview.
Well, you can edit it out. You know,
it's okay. I'm just joking. But
you can
go
edit
ahead.
It out.
But, no, know, no. I'm going to leave it in. I'm going to leave it in.
Les Pauls are the shit.
Yeah. No. I mean,
and just think about how many great guitar players have played Les Pauls.
Oh yeah.
From Jimmy Page to Billy Gibbons. Keith Richards. I mean, the name goes, it's endless.
So do you have any of those Les Pauls from the 70s that, you know?
Yeah, I have about
You still held
60,
on to that stuff?
I have about 25 Les Pauls at home. I just recently found a 50, where is it? Oh, here. Yeah, this Les Paul is what I used to play in the 70s with Kiss. And I found it without pickups in it, and I had to, like, restore it.
Is this the one that had, like, the smoking pickup and all that stuff?
No.
Oh.
That was just a standard one with no modifications, except I was the first guitar player to take a triple pickup Les Paul and make everything cream. And even I'd even take the back plates off, and I had a guy custom make me cream covers. So the whole guitar is black and cream, you know?
And then did Gibson start doing
and then
that
Gibson
after?
Copied it
really?
And
really?
The rest is history. You know?
Did you ever go to them like, hey, where's my royalty, boys?
Oh, Gibson has put out three Ace Frehley models.
Right.
The AFS, the Budokan, and the 59. So, you know, I still get royalty checks from them.
Well, I wanted to...
They're probably going to stop now that because they just filed for Chapter 11.
Right.
But I was talking to one of the guys at the party last night who worked for Gibson, and he said, you know, they're looking for people to, you know, it's owned by the bank now.
Right.
So,
but I heard that the guitar part of the company is actually in profit. It's all the other stuff that they bought that is
dragging. Well, Henry Jerskowitz was the president and a good friend of mine. For some reason, he went out and started buying all these other unrelated
companies. And this, that, and the other.
He bought Slingerland Drums. He bought... that's not unrelated, but, you know, to a guitar company, it is a drum company. And I actually ended up getting a set of Slingerland drums from them, a really high-end kit, and I still use it to this day in my studio.
What, you play it?
No. I have the set. I have the drum set set up.
Right.
You know, and I had Anton Figg pick out the cymbals.
Is Anton Figg still playing on your stuff after all these
years? Actually, Anton's playing on two songs on this record, but...
No shit.
He played the drum tracks a long time ago. Off My Back and Pursuit of Rock and Roll, I recorded those two tracks with Anton, and 10, 15, 20 years ago. So I had to transfer them from 2-inch tape to digital hard drive. And then what I did is when I imported them into Pro Tools, I just erased everything except the drum track and rewrote the lyrics and the music.
Ah.
Improved what was already there on those songs. But the drum tracks were flawless.
And he played on your first solo record.
He played on several of my solo albums.
But then was he playing on like your songs on Kiss records, sort of moving beyond that?
He did play on a couple of Kiss records. You know, I forget which songs they were. But Peter was absent at the time, so we brought Anton in. And then, you know... He actually toured with me a few times, but, you know, he got tied in with the David Letterman show, and that kind of put a damper on his touring abilities. Mm. So I hired another drummer to tour with. But every once in a while, Anton would come out and play or sit in, and he still does to this day. I just played with him at the Kiss Expo in Indianapolis. He flew in to do a reunion with me, Anton, John Reagan, and Todd Howarth.
So, how did you guys connect? Were you guys just friends in New York City in the music scene?
How did me and Anton meet?
Yeah.
Well, it was an interesting story. I was looking for a drummer to do my solo album, you know. I had just left the meeting with Kiss, and, you know, we all decided to go off on our own.
Right.
And do solo records. So, I was lucky enough to get Eddie Kramer to produce it. You know, who did Live 1
sure.
and 2.
Yeah.
And me and him had a good working relationship, so I was really happy about that. And then, you know...
Did he do Rock and Roll Over, too?
Yes.
Right.
We recorded that up in Westchester in the Theater in the Round. We actually bastardized this office and made a studio in this office and ran... wire, you know, snakes down to the stage, which was a circular stage, and that's where we recorded Rock and Roll Over.
And you recorded it live? Like
a lot
the basic
of it was
tracks?
Live, yeah.
Is that how you did the first few records? Were those just sort of live and then a little bit of overdubs afterwards?
The first few records, we would go in and pretty much play as a band and then overdub, and, you know. It's the complete opposite of how I record today,
right?
And how I recorded my first solo album. Pretty much, I usually just play to a click track, put down the rhythm track, put down a scratch bass, you know, then double the rhythm track, and then put down a scratch vocal, and then get a drummer to come in and play to the click track with headphones, and then I'll end up doing the guitar solo.
Do you write your guitar solos?
No.
Because your guitar solos are always, they're like parts of the song.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this because I was listening to a Kiss Alive this morning to just get ready for this. And you had to cover so much fucking space in those songs. I mean, your guitar solos, sometimes some of those songs have like three long sections of guitar solos. How much of that was just kind of winging it and how much of that was mapped out?
90% of it's winging it. You know, in the early days, I used to rehearse guitar solos, you know, with Kiss, you know, on the first couple of albums. they'd send me, they'd give me a cassette without a solo on it, and then I'd play to it, and I'd work out a solo. I'd get into the studio, and they didn't like it. So I said to myself, well, you just spent the whole afternoon working on something that somebody didn't like. So, you know, as my career progressed and my playing got better and my confidence got better, I just decided to wing the solos. And what we did with that, what Eddie Kramer used to do is, you know, we were recording on 24-track, 2-inch tape. What we do is get two machines, sync them together, and make a slave reel. You know, with just a stereo mix of drums, rhythm track, vocal, and bass. And then we'd have like 12 tracks to play with.
Mm.
And then I'd just do solo after solo after solo, and then we'd, you know, make a composite.
Right, right, right.
And now it's so much easier to do that. Because, you know, it's a click of the mouse.
Sure.
Compositing a solo. Back then, we'd have to cut the tape. And that was a bitch.
How long did you guys spend in the studio?
It would be hours. You know, because you're cutting tape with a razor blade, and then you're taking the part and put it aside. Then you have to piece it back together, and then listen and go, that's almost right. And
right,
sometimes we
right.
have like pieces of tape a quarter of an inch wide
yeah.
that we'd have to put back on to make the solo work.
Well, tell me about Shock Me. Tell me about, like, how did it happen?
Well, it was
that you
inspired
wound up-
by an incident that happened in Lakeland, Florida, when I was performing with Kiss. I got electrocuted at the beginning of the show.
Mm.
And I passed out, and I got, you know, knocked on my ass. And then they carried me down the staircase and revived me, and I had burns on my finger.
Mm.
That was before wireless guitars.
Right.
So, you know, Paul made an announcement that, you know, Ace has been injured by the Bobby. And then, you know, in a couple of minutes, the whole arena started chanting, Ace, 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 Ace. So, you know, my adrenaline started pumping. I had no feeling in my fingers, but I still played the rest of the show.
Really?
Yeah. But I got scared because, you know, I had read an article that, you know, one of the people that got electrocuted on stage died 3 days later.
Oh, shit.
So I'm saying
she's like waiting for the other
shoe to drop.
I hope
I'm not going to die in a couple of days, but luckily, you know, I have a strong heart and I'm a healthy guy.
Well, so how did that become a song then?
Well, I
like what made you finally like, all right, I'm gonna step up to the mic. I'm gonna sing a song.
I mean, you know, you're a songwriter, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I just you take, you know, I usually come up with a guitar riff and then add the lyrics later.
Right.
You know, sometimes I come up with a vocal line that grabs me, and then I write music to it. But it's usually the opposite way. Usually I write the music first, the lyrics come second, and then the solos, you know, is the icing on the cake.
So, like, how much did it change the dynamics of the band once you guys made the solo records and yours was the hit? Like, was, because, I mean, having, been, you know, not been one of the lead singers in the band prior to that, I mean, what is that?
It changed the dynamic in the band. Paul and Gene were reluctant to congratulate me and say that my album did the best. I mean, to this day, I don't think Gene's going to say that my album was the best. He thinks his album did the best, you know.
Isn't there a verifiable way of measuring that?
Somebody said to me in an interview the other day, they said, well, after you guys released those four solo albums, obviously you guys sat down at a table and had a meeting and talked about it. And, you know.
That's not how bands work,
though,
right?
That never happened.
No, that never happened.
The reason it never happened was because they didn't want to sit at a table with me and say, hey, your record did the best. They didn't want to admit it.
Right. Yeah, right. I mean, were things already sort of unraveling internally, and then that was sort of pushed you in it, you know, further down that road?
Yeah, Paul and Gene have huge egos. I mean, Gene's ego is probably the biggest. And I love Gene. He's my brother, rock and roll brother.
And you guys have been doing some stuff.
Yeah, we just went to Australia together. We had a blast. But, you know, I mean, here's a line I got from Bobby Kennedy Jr. when I talked to him about Gene Simmons. He goes, oh, that guy, you used to work with him? He goes, yeah. He talks about three people all the time, me, myself, and I. You know? He likes to toot his own horn.
But that's
Gene. I'm used to it. Other people sometimes find it abrasive.
I don't know him, but from the outside looking in, you know, I sort of think of like Kiss in the original years as like three kind of distinct eras. You know, there's everything up to Alive. That's like sort of one section. There's everything up to Alive 2. That's another section. Those records are sort of a sound and a, you know, have a consistency there.
We were constantly evolving.
Right. And then there's that period after that where you guys do the solo albums, and then it seems like the cracks appear at that point, you know? I mean, and I don't know what the truth is about any of it, but like,
well, you got to realize in real life, you know, Gene started dating Cher.
Right.
And then he went to Diana Ross next. And we were all upset about that because he was getting covers on People magazine.
Mm.
And we're going to Gene, what about the band? You know, you promoting yourself? You know, we're a band. You know, don't forget, Kiss should be number one.
Right.
And so that caused some disharmony and discord in the band. But then, you know, what did I do? I went out and started partying like an animal, crashing cars. And, you know, we all dealt with it in different ways. You know, and if you read Paul's book, he says that at that point, he was basically running Kiss. I don't know how true that is. You know, I mean, Gene was always involved with Kiss in one way or the other. Maybe Paul had to do more in during that period of time when Gene was off hanging out with starlets. But, you know.
Well, I mean, it was an interesting time in rock music because around that, when you hit that like late 70s into the early 80s, you know, rock music was kind of changing. There was this like new crop of kind of more aggressive, harder, heavy metal bands. And the pre-existing rock bands kind of dealt with that in different ways. You know, some tried to be more heavy metal, some didn't. And I think of that period in Kiss is like, you know, Dynasty was a huge record, but the big hit on it was kind of like a disco song, you know, which like did that wind up having, did that sort of like veering into a different sort of genre thing. Did that ultimately have a negative impact on the band?
I thought it did because I think the disco song connotation itself turned off the hard rock, heavy metal fans that were, you know, really true fans that were with us from the beginning, you know. But, you know, from what I understand, I Was Made for Loving You was the biggest hit that Kiss ever had.
Oh, really? When I think of Dynasty and Unmasked and Music from the Elder, to me, your songs are the high points on those records.
Okay,
you know,
well,
like
thank you very
and just
much.
Like your solo record was the rock record of the four solo records. You know, the other ones were less like rock, and your songs on like Unmasked, which is not a very rock album. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got like three rock songs on it, right. Or like Hard Times on Dynasty.
I've never changed
like a rock
my
song.
Style or the way I write, or I've never done anything against that goes against the grain or because it's fashionable. You know, disco was big when Paul wrote "I Was Made for Loving You," so he wrote a disco song. You know, you'd have to torture me to try to write a disco song, and you still wouldn't. You know, you'd have to kill me. Disco is disco. You know, rock and roll is rock and roll. Never the Twain Shall Meet. And well, I used to hate playing that song live because I used to go chucka.
Right.
So halfway through the song, sometimes
my hand would
cramp up.
Right, yeah, sure.
You know, it was tough. And but we had to do it every night because it was a hit.
I love the guitar solo on that song. That's like a great example of what I was talking about before. Like it's lyrical, like, you know, it's like a hook. It's like part of the, it's like another part, you know?
Yeah, I mean, somebody said to me, I forget who it was, or somebody said, you know, it's not the notes you play, it's the notes you leave out.
Mm.
And, you know, I try to stay away from the super fast stuff that like speed metal groups do. You know, some of the best solos are the ones you can sing.
Oh, for
sure.
And you
can hum.
For sure.
So I always keep that in the back of my mind when I'm writing solos, and I like to repeat lines. I'll start off with a line, then go somewhere else, and then come back to it. You know, so people's brain can process that and go, oh, I've heard that before.
Yeah.
I opened up the solo with it, or I'd end with the part that I started with.
You do that thing in a lot of your solos that's almost like a chicken picking thing. You know, there's like that.
Chicken
picking. Yeah, you know what I mean? It's like that plucky, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. The whole thing is, hitting the pick with the hitting the string with the pick and your finger at the same time, which gives you harmonics.
Right. Yeah, yeah, sure.
It's a technique that I've developed over the years that some guitar players have no clue. Like Tommy Thayer, he doesn't do it. God bless Tommy, but
I have to tell you, he can copy
the notes, but he just doesn't have the technique.
I have to tell you, I posted across my socials yesterday that I was interviewing you today.
Yeah.
And the single, and I said, like, you know, do you have any questions for Ace or whatever? And I got a million responses, but the one that I got the most was, are you taking part in this farewell tour?
I haven't been asked.
Really? Because it seems like with Paul playing on, what, your last record, and you've done some stuff with Gene. And I remember when you first left, you know, the reunion era Kiss.
Yeah, that was some bad blood.
Right, some bad blood. It seems like that's all softened now. You know, I don't know. Yeah. Like, you think you'll be a part of
I can't tell you. I can only be honest, you know. When Paul and Gene call me up and say, do you want to do a reunion tour and write me a big check, you know, I'll probably be there. If it doesn't happen, it's not going to happen. What are you going to do? You know, I'm fine. You know, my career is on an upswing. And everybody that's heard this new album thinks it's one of the best records I've ever done, if not the best record.
Is your solo career this time bigger than your solo career in the 80s?
Is my solo tour?
Like, it seems like your solo records, like, every time they come out now, there's, like, a lot of hoopla around. Like, you know, like, they seem like they do well.
And my records are doing, everybody's getting hip to my records. And young guitar players are listening to my solos and emulating them. And, you know, it's great. You know, it's like a resurgence of Ace Frehley, you know. When I put out Anomaly in 2009, obviously it didn't do as well as some of the records I've done, you know, since then. But, you know, I'm real happy with this new album, and the record company thinks it's going to be my best-selling record to date.
It sounded great at the listening party last night, and I got to say, I love the album cover. I love,
Did you meet Warren Huart? He's the guy who mixed it.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't
think
so.
Great mixer. You know, me and him are in sync because he knows how to get that vintage sound. And I strive to get that prior to giving it to him by using old preamps, old microphones, old classic amps.
So what are you going to do next then? Are you hitting the road soon?
Well, what's happening is this album's coming out on the 19th. I'm going to New York on the 15th to do press for the album. You know, so I'm pretty much doing the same thing I'm doing here in California, in New York for 4 or 5 days. And then I fly to Vegas because I'm doing a signing at Kiss Mini Golf. And I'm also walking some people down the aisle. I don't know how that happened. I got a phone call. Wait, and said, Ace, you want to do this for X amount of dollars?
Explain it. How did that come to be? Because somebody mentioned that to me last night.
I got a phone call from Keith LaRue. He's Paul and Gene's assistant. But he's also been working with me a lot as of late. And he's putting together this autograph signing. And then out of the blue, he goes, Ace, you want to walk people down the aisle for, you know, the whole thing will take you 15 minutes and you'll get a big chunk of money. And I said, why not? You know, I mean, obviously they're going to be Kiss fans if they're going to cough up that much money.
Yeah, yeah.
And it'll be a thrill for them and it'll be fun.
You know, my wedding was like 15 years ago. Where were you then, buddy?
I don't know. This is a first for me.
Oh, really? Okay.
So after I do the ceremonies and the autograph session in Vegas, I fly to Miami for the Kiss Cruise.
Mm.
And then after the Kiss Cruise, I have 4 shows in Florida. And then I come back and I'm going to start recording Origins Volume 2. And then the only dates I have booked after that is after Christmas up in Northern California. 3 or 4 shows are coming together. You know, I got a big casino date, you know. They offered me a lot of bread, and then we're surrounding it with some other shows. So I'll be doing 3 or 4 shows in January, and that's all I have so far on my calendar.
At this stage in your life and career, I mean, you must every single day of your life have people like me come up to you and go, oh my God, you're the reason I play guitar, blah, blah. You're my favorite guitar player, blah, blah. Like, how do you sort of reflect on your legacy and influence.
I don't think that much about the past. I try to stay in the now and look towards the future. It's very flattering when guitar players say that to me. You know, but there's a part of me that I'm saying, these guys are idolizing my guitar style and I never took a guitar lesson. So it's kind of strange and I feel a little guilty almost at times. I go, you're emulating and loving this guitar player who I don't even know what half the things I play are called.
You don't have to.
You know, if it sounds good, do it. That, you know, that's the beauty of rock and roll, and that's the way rock and roll started out. And as far as I'm concerned, that's the way rock and roll is today.
I mean, who do you think out of today's crop of guitar players or in rock bands?
Do you pay attention to that stuff? I don't listen to any new music, and I haven't for a long time. I live in a bubble.
What's your bubble?
I work on my own stuff. I go fishing. You know, I go gambling in Vegas. We go on vacation, me and Rachel. And then, you know, we go to bed early and, you know, we watch Netflix or Amazon. I don't watch TV. I don't watch the news. I hate it. And I can't handle commercials.
Hmm.
You know, when I'm in hotels, I get stuck with commercials.
Minus the gambling, you pretty much described the bubble that I live in as well. So I think we're all in our own bubbles.
It's not
here.
A bad way to live today. Not watching the news is very healthy.
It's very good for you right now at this juncture in history.
There's so much junk.
Oh, yeah, there is. That's a whole other story. Okay, so you don't know if you're going to be involved in any of this farewell tour stuff.
I mean, I haven't been asked.
What do you think?
If I was a gambling man?
You are a gambling man.
Okay, I am a gambling man. If I had to bet, I would probably say better than 50-50 odds that they'd be silly not to want to involve me. Because
sure. But then won't you kind of look
back on... I'm going to sell more tickets. They're going to sell more tickets with me than Tommy
Kaye. For sure, but won't you kind of look back at like not playing at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame...
Yeah.
Thing is sort of like, well, if we're doing this now, why the fuck didn't we do it then? You know?
Well, you got to remember, when you go back in history, we did that unplugged thing.
Right.
With the original
guys. Sure. Yeah.
And look what happened.
Right.
The fans demanded a reunion tour.
Yeah.
And they had to scrap the album that they had just recorded with Bruce.
Right.
You know, that never got released.
What, once you guys started doing the reunion stuff, how long did it take for. So some of the old cracks to sort of resurface.
We rehearsed here in L.A. for a couple of months, I think. And, we went to the gym every day and worked out. You know, we got in shape.
But how long did it take for sort of old complaints and things to start to rear their heads?
Oh, you mean why did I end up leaving after 5 years?
Well, you and Peter both, you know?
Well, you know, it just certain things started happening beyond my control that I wasn't happy with. Deals were being made that I wasn't privy to or getting a percentage of.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, in the beginning, you know, I thought I was getting a percentage of everything, you know, but that's, you know, things started falling through the cracks, you know, they started pushing my buttons. Eventually, I just said, I don't need this. And, you know, longed for putting back together a solo band and recording another record. But it took a while because, you know, drugs and alcohol were clouding my decisions. Mm. And, you know, I got sober in 2006 and just celebrated 12 years sober.
Mm.
So, you know, my life has been a roller coaster ride, up and down, up and down. But I'm almost kind of addicted to it.
Right.
You know?
Well, here's
it's like, when everything goes smooth, you want to throw a monkey wrench into it because it's not exciting.
It's too smooth.
You know,
yeah.
I used to say to people, I don't want to know where I'm going to be a year from now. I don't want to know what I'm doing. I like the surprise.
Right.
I like the spontaneity of not knowing.
Here's a question. Why do you think those two have stayed together through all these different incarnations of Kiss?
Because from the outside, they have completely different personalities.
Well, that's what I was going to say. From the outside looking in, they don't seem particularly compatible either.
They're, to be honest, neither of them are really quite fond of each other. The last thing I heard is that Paul has his own dressing room, and that completely shocked me.
Hmm.
Because we always used to put on our makeup together, you know, like four girls in a beauty parlor.
Right.
You know,
right,
with four mirrors, and we'd be, you know, we'd be talking while we're putting the makeup on. It was a ritual.
Yeah.
You know,
when you start having separate dressing rooms, that's like,
that's
the beginning of the end.
That doesn't appeal to me. I if I was to be asked to come back to the band, you know, I would want everybody to, you know, put the makeup on and get ready together like we used to, you know, like old times.
Yeah. Forces you to have a little conversation.
Yeah.
Check in with each other.
It's a good, and it's actually a relaxing time. We don't let anybody in the dressing room except, you know, the guys doing our hair, and we have a couple of girls that dress us, you know, once we get the makeup on. And, it's kind of a, you know, we never get a chance to see the opening act because we're getting ready.
You could never have been able to keep your faces hidden now, right? Like,
now the cat's out of the bag. There's no going back.
Well, I know, but I'm saying, like, back in, like, the 70s, did music journalists sort of play along and help you keep your faces hidden? I mean, like, that, like, how
we,
that...
We kept, I mean, you know what? The magazines had photos of us, a lot of the top magazines, but they didn't print them.
Right. Now, that would never happen now.
They didn't want the mystique to die because they were selling a lot of magazines with us in makeup. They didn't want to blow it.
Let me tell you, getting back to what I talked about at the beginning of going to that birthday party in 77 when I was a little kid, the most fucked up part of that was that nobody ever believed me. Because when I went back to school on Monday and I was like, I was at a birthday party with all of Kiss and none of them had their makeup on and they were dressed in like suits and shit. Everyone's just like, get the fuck out of here, you were.
Well,
because it was like an impossible belief at that point to have seen Kiss without their makeup. Just didn't happen.
I remember, you know, in my heyday, I went out to a bar and I met this beautiful brunette, you know, with a body, you know, like a Venus. And we had a couple of drinks, you know, we were getting along. And then obviously I wanted to take her home with me. And I told her I was Ace Frehley, and she goes, get the fuck out of here. She goes, I'm a huge fan. I go, no, but I really am Ace Frehley. She goes, get the fuck out of here. So I had to start pulling out my ID. Right.
She's like, that says Paul. That didn't say Ace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you know anything about Ace Frehley, he has a brother named Charlie and not Paul. And, you know, Paul was changed to Ace. You know, in the beginning of the band, when it was in the incarnation of the band. Or whatever. I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm in the Matrix. I go in and out of reality, in and out of my bubble. But it's okay. It's all good.
It's been very good, dude. Thank you so much for sitting down and talking with me.
It's my pleasure.
I just can't even tell you how much of a pleasure
this is.
You
had some good questions.
It's so hard to interview somebody that you're such a big fan of that also has a long career. Because there's just so fucking much to talk about. And I could sit here and talk to you all fucking day, but I know you got shit to do. So thank you. All right, that was Ace Frehley, the rock soldier himself, right here on Walking the Floor. I think I could pretty much quit podcasting at this point. That was like the biggest dream come true interview I think I've done so far. So hard to top. Make sure you get on over to walkingthefloor.com. I'm going to put a bunch of links up to all the stuff we talked about so you can go check out where Ace is, what he's up to, stream his music, buy his tickets, etc., and so on. And once again, a big special thanks to Fender Play for their support. If any of you listeners out there are interested in shrouding on the guitar without all the usual hassles, go check out your free trial of Fender Play by visiting fender.com/walkingthefloor. And maybe you too can rip like Ace Frehley, if you're lucky, if you work hard, kids. Okay, that's it for this week. I'll see you in a couple weeks with Who the Hell Knows? Who cares? That was Ace Frehley on Walking the Floor. Adios, amigos!